Support for this podcast and the following message come from Dignity Memorial. When your celebration of life is prepaid today, your family is protected tomorrow. Planning ahead is truly one of the best gifts you can give your family. For additional information, visit dignitymemorial.com.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. This month on our show, we are going to be doing something a little bit different. We are ringing in 50 years of hip-hop by interviewing all rappers all month. And we're kicking things off with, in my opinion, the greatest ever to do it, Rakim. I think there is a line between what you might call early hip-hop and modern hip-hop. And that line, well, I say it's a line, it's basically a guy, Rakim. Take a listen to 5 Minutes of Funk, which is a great song from 1984 by the rap group Houdini. The MC there is Jaleel Hutchins, and listen to his flow.
Now the party didn't start till I walked in, and I probably won't leave until the thing ends. But in the meantime, the in-between time, if you work your thing, then I work mine. We came here together so we could have fun. Me and you, baby, going one-on-one. Now this is the last chance for us to get off. So either get loose or you ought to get lost.
The rhymes hit with the snare drum. One, two, three, four. I mean, that is a classic style. And it's that way pretty much throughout all the titular 5 Minutes of Funk. And again, not a bad song, actually a great song. It's just back then, that's kind of how most rap songs went. Now, fast forward 3 years. This is I Ain't No Joke by Eric B. and Rakim. Rakim is the rapper here. And it's very, very different.
They think that I'm a new jack, but only if they knew that. They who think wrong or they who can't do that style that I'm doing, they might ruin patterns and paragraphs based on you. And you're all BDJ, if anything he play sound familiar, I'll wait to East say play him. So I'ma have to diss who broke. You can get a smack for this. I ain't no joke.
Look, this is a rap about rapping. The subject matter isn't exactly revolutionary. And Rakim was barely old enough to vote when he put this down. But when you hear it, the complexity, the rhythm, the flow, it is both intricate and effortless. The rhymes flit between the abstract and the concrete, metaphor and reality in mind-bending ways. Ask any rapper or any aspiring rapper who was alive at the time, and they will tell you this changed their life. And you know what? It still sounds great more than 30 years later. I've got so much to get into with Rakim, how he met Eric B., how they met Marley Marl, how Rakim looks back on his entire career now that he is a man in his 50s. And I don't want to waste any more of your time before we get into it. So let's kick things off with another classic from Eric B. and Rakim. Don't Sweat the Technique.
Don't sweat the technique. Let's trace the hits and check the file. Let's see who bit the dot, check the style. I flip the script so it can't get filed. At least not now, it'll take a while. I change the pace to complete the beat. I drop the bass to MCs get weak, but every road they trace is a scar they keep. It's when I speak, they freak, they sweat the technique.
Rakim, welcome to Bullseye. I'm so happy to have you on the show.
Thank you so much, man. Thanks for the welcome, man.
I'm very genuinely thrilled. So you grew up in Long Island, which, you know, at the time that you were growing up, could have felt pretty far from the beginnings of hip-hop.
Yeah, indeed. So
did it feel like it was coming from a long way away?
Yeah, I always felt like I was on the outside looking in, you know, knowing and also knowing the speed of things in the inner city compared to living in Long Island, you know. I knew they had the advantage and all the resources right there. So it was definitely hard trying to, make your mark, you know.
Did you first hear hip hop like on the radio?
Nah. Growing up in Wine Dance as a young kid, there was always DJs in the park, block parties, and even my brother used to have parties at the house. Luckily, my brother knew the DJs personally, so they used to bring their equipment over to the house and sometimes let them hold it for a week or two. So I was always around it, fortunately, at a very young age. I was listening to hip-hop before the first rap record came out, King Tim III, Fatback Bad. I remember sitting in the basement with my brother and his friends, one of them a DJ, Paul Garrard. His name was DJ Maniac. And I remember the day he came to the house and told my brother, wait till you hear this, wait till you hear this. And he gets downstairs and puts on King Tim III, and that's the first record we heard with rap on it.
You're the youngest of five, is that total? Is that right?
Yes.
So
yes.
You had two older brothers and two older sisters.
Yes.
Were they into hip-hop or were they into other stuff?
Well, luckily, my two sisters sang. My two brothers played instruments. My oldest brother, Ronnie, played keyboards, and he was able to play other instruments and write music. And my brother, Stevie, he played the saxophone. And I tried to do everything Stevie did, so I wound up playing the saxophone as well.
What kind of music did they like?
Well, going to the top, moms and pops played all kind of good R&B and jazz music, man. I remember... you know, being a young kid and hearing so much jazz and, you know, I liked it. You know what I mean? And I remember being a young kid trying to understand jazz because the first thing I understood was like the timing was different. R&B was, you know, mostly 4-4 time. 1-2-3-4, 2-2-3. You know, all the way up to 4, and then, you know, we start back over. But jazz, the timing in jazz, I remember listening to it, like, you know, just noticing right away that the timing and the rhythms was different and very intricate. And I think that's what gave me a profound understanding of time and space. I felt 4-4 time was very easy, and the rhythms that I was hearing in jazz records was, you know, what I was trying to emulate.
Your sort of auntie who like babysat you was Ruth Brown, one of the greatest R&B singers incredible. Of all time.
Yes, incredible.
And when I say R&B singers, I mean, I'm talking about from the dawn of R&B, when R&B was rhythm and blues. So she was sort of pre rock and roll, soul music R&B singer, early 50s, she started having hit records. She was such a big star at the peak of her career that she was a star throughout her life. You know what I mean? Like she worked.
Yes.
Were you aware of that when you were a kid?
Yes. What's crazy is I remember sitting there watching her, and it could be a normal day. You know, 9 times out of 10, I wouldn't know what was going on in her life if I, you know, just watched her. Meaning, you know, a normal day, she would get up, watch TV, relax. She had her favorite snacks. She loved Slim Jims. world up. And I remember, because I used to steal them. She used to have them all around the house. I remember sitting there watching her, and it'll be a normal day. And then she'll get up, go in her room, go in the closet, grab like a top shawl or something, right? She'll throw it on this big table that she had where she did a lot of her clothes at, right? She'll throw it on there. She'll walk around the house. She'll do something. She might sit down and watch a little more TV. Then she'll grab some glue, right? She'll go over to the shawl she just laid on this table, and she'll take the glue and just squirt the glue all over the shirt. Let that sit for a minute. She'll get this glitter. Come back, throw the glitter on the shirt, let that dry, she'll shake it off. And I'm sitting there watching her make her outfit, bro. She'll buy some regular, you know, nice stuff in the store, but she'll decorate it to make it look stage worthy. So I'm sitting there watching her. She might, you know, glitter up pants or a big hat, whatever she's doing. She sit back down, watch TV, eat her snacks. And me not knowing that she has a show that night. So, you know, I started figuring out, like, you know, her movements. Like, whenever I seen her starting to get clothes ready and put glue and glitter and all of this stuff on it, I knew she had a show that night. But she was so laid back and so down to earth, you would never know. She never showed, like, any kind of, you know, nervousness. Or I guess she was the same person getting ready for the show and preparing for the show, you know, that I seen babysitting me. So, you know, it was a blessing watching that, man. You know, it let me know how to prepare for a show, you know. Just keep a cool state of mind and, you know, stay calm, relax, do what you normally do, and get ready for the task at hand. But it was a blessing, man, to just be able to watch her, man.
That's something that kind of goes three ways. I mean, it is like, first of all, somebody in show business is a normal human being.
Well,
that's one of the things. Number two, it's somebody in show business is glittering and glamorous. You know, she's got glitter on the big hat, right?
Facts.
And number three is the thing that's in between those two, which is that in order for her to transform herself into the glamorous stage presence that I'm sure she was, you know, it's a pretty like straightforward thing to be gluing glitter to your clothes. You know what I mean? Like, it's not like she went to Bulgari and had them encrust things in crystal, right? It's like you are getting that glamour through the most quotidian work that there is. You just some glue and some glitter.
Right. And just seeing, you know, how creative she was. You know what I mean? Like, you know, singing and having stage presence and all that's one thing, but being able to kind of create your own outfit before you get on stage, you know, it just shows the different dimensions of, you know, who she was. And, you know, and it's funny, you know what I mean? I do the same thing. I might have something that I'm wearing that night and maybe the hat don't match everything perfectly. You know, I got a Yankee hat, you know, it got a white Yankee sign, but I need a red Yankee sign. So I break out the Sharpie and make the, you know, sign red. So it's almost like when you're on stage and you improvise. And it's the same thing, man. So, you know, like, you know, I need to match this up. I paint Timberlands, I paint Nikes, everything. And it's the same thing she was doing.
You always did that, right? You were painting sneakers when you were a kid, like a teenager.
Yes, sir. Back in high school. It's funny, when I met Biz Markie, that's one of the things we vibed about. He used to always come up to my school with different painted sneakers. And I remember the first time, like, he didn't know I painted them too. But the first time he had on a brown and black pair of Adidas. So I looked at him, I was like, yo, those is crazy. And it was done nice too, nice and neat. I said, yo, those crazy bits. Where you get them from, man? He said, my pops owned a sneaker store in Long Island, something like that. You know what I mean? But later on, I told him, I know. I said, come on, man, you painted those. They don't make brown Adidas with black stripes, bro. I said, come on. So we used to laugh. But yeah, man, you know, trying to, number one, be original, unique, and try to have something that nobody else can get their hands on. So I think that painting sneakers was kind of, you know, start of me being original and trying to stand out.
More still to come with Rakim. Stay with us. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR. This message comes from Apple Card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase. That's 3% on products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card, issued by Goldman Sachs Bank, USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval, terms apply.
In this country, more than two local newspapers are closing down each week. As news deserts grow, public radio is a lifeline for staying informed. Keep that service strong with a donation to the NPR network at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
Welcome back to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. If you're just joining us, my guest is the rapper Rakim. In the late 1980s and early 1990s, he changed the way rappers rap in a way that no other MC ever has. Let's get back into our conversation. There used to be a thread on this this discussion board for DJs and crate diggers called Soul Strut. It was just like dozens and dozens and dozens of people sharing stories of primarily getting woken up in the middle of the night by a phone call from Biz Markie, who they had never met before, but somebody gave Biz their phone number. And wow. Him just asking them what kind of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles they have.
Yeah, Biz was a big kid, man. He loved toys. He loved, you know, his energy, man. Like, I remember being around Biz, and he made you love rap more. You know what I mean? Looking for records or record shopping. He made you want to do that better than everybody else. Like, you know, the energy that he had, man, you know, was just always high energy. Loved hip hop and loved the fact that he was a part of it and he knew everybody that was in it, man. I mean, you know, just, you know, R.I.P. to Biz, man.
How did the two of you meet?
We met out in Long Island at my high school. It's funny. I don't know how he found out about the school, but he came up to the school one day and came to the back of the school where the cafeteria area is, where everybody's kind of hanging out, and was doing the beatbox. And somebody ran over to me like, yo, what's this dude over here doing the beatbox? So I run to the back of the hallway where the cafeterias are. And, you know, before I get there, I can hear, you know, his voice, you know, illuminating through the hallways. And I'm like, okay, because people played around with the beatbox around my way. It wasn't nobody that good, you know what I mean? So right away, you know, I knew that this kid knew what he was doing. So I get over to him. He got the Adidas on, the shell tops, the baggy jeans on. He got the cap on, and he rocking beatboxing. So, of course, I start rhyming. And, you know, the rest was history, man. After that, we start chopping it up. He was telling me, you know, a little bit of his background and what he do. And it went from that to the sneakers and the whole thing, man. And we just kept in touch. He would come out to Long Island and come straight to the school. And it got so crazy, like for a little while, the security guards would let him in. And then it got so crazy because people were, you know, we was drawing too much attention that they had to stop him from coming up to the school. But, you know, it was dope, man. I remember he was like, yo, Ross, it's a MC battle convention in Manhattan, 127th Street. Now, at this time, you know, I'm in Long Island. I'm maybe 10th grade, maybe. You know, I wouldn't pick up and go to a show in New York and get on the mic. So Biz was like, yes, it's a convention. I'm like, yeah, so would you? He was like, yo, you should join. You should enter. I'm like, yo, man, I'm not entering no battle in Harlem, man. He was like, yo, Rob, man, yo, you good. You nice, man. So he talked me into it. And that's what I mean about Biz. Like, he just made you love whatever you thought you liked. You know, Biz let you know, no, this, yo, let's go. You're going to be good. They're going to go crazy when they hear you. And like I said, we went. It was an event put together by the Crash Crew. It was maybe 1985. I remember Doug Fresh was there. I think Melly Mel was there. But I remember I got on, performed, and people gave me a good response. It was a brother from the neighborhood named Kid West that won. He was basically two blocks over, so everybody kind of knew him. But he was nice, and I learned a lot that night. But I definitely gained a lot of confidence because I didn't know that I would do that good in Harlem, New York City. You know what I mean? The place that I knew held the bar on what I was trying to do.
There's tapes of you and Biz performing when you're teenagers.
Yeah,
the first question I guess I have is, why are there tapes of you? Like, who had the sense to be like, we should record this?
Yeah, we, you know, everybody was in love with hip hop. Everybody was kind of playing their part. You had, you know, rappers that would write rhymes before party, you know, preparing. And you also had the cast to be like, yo, I'm gonna make sure I record this because, you know, I think it was DJ Bilal in Long Island that recorded a lot of those, man. But we was making a little noise in the neighborhood, so you know we was kind of popular, man.
Let's hear a little bit of my guest Rakim, at the time known as Kid Wizard, rapping with Biz Markie beatboxing. That's so great to hear.
That's crazy, man. That's crazy.
What's wild is I guess you're probably like 16 or something like that. You sound like a real pro. You don't sound like you sound, you know, a year or two later when you started recording, but you sound like I could have fun at that party. You know what I mean?
Word up, man. I guess listening to Grandmaster Caz, Melly Mel, and Kumo D, you know, those is my teachers, man. And just being a big fan of hip hop, you know, I tried to get my hands on all the cassette tapes that I could that was going around the neighborhood from the early Grandmaster Flash and, you know, Cold Crush Brothers, Fantastic Five. And just learning from them, you know, I had an idea how it was supposed to sound. But I think not until I knew I was going to make a record, it all kind of came together, man. All of these things was preparing me for the moment. But I definitely think I made a quantum leap from there to, you know, the first records that we did. You know, it just let me know, like, the whole world was going to listen, and I had to come correct, and that style came together.
To my ear, I mean, like, Kool Moe Dee is kind of like the bridge between that first wave of great rappers and the wave that, you know, you and Big Daddy Kane sort of headlined, and that, you know, right. There was rapping for a long time was, you know, ba 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 or similar, right? It was just like, let's have some fun up here, and the loop from Good Times is playing.
Facts.
And which, nothing wrong with that. That's great. Like, no doubt. It's legit great. You know, you could put on those Sugar Hill Greatest Hits CDs right now, and we would all have a great time.
No doubt.
But Kool Moe Dee sort of started to investigate the possibilities of, you know, what if there were more internal rhymes? What if the meter was a little bit more than just the 1, 2, 3, 4 that you described?
Right.
How did you get the idea that it should be a lot more than just that 1, 2, 3, 4?
I think my background, you know, listening to a lot of different music, and like I said, that jazz music gave me a better understanding of time and space. One day I was downstairs and a John Coltrane, you know, record was playing downstairs in my mother's mother and father's basement. And for some reason, as soon as it came on, I was stuck to the record. And I remember not moving. I sat there. I was sitting in front of the shelves where their records are. And I used to often just look at certain album covers when, you know, they was playing music. But this day I remembered when the record came on, I was kind of just gazing at, like, the ground. The record started playing, and I was hooked from the first note to the last. The record went off, and I was, like, almost exhausted. Like, you wanted to cut the record back on, or, like, you didn't know what to do after the record, you know, went off. The first thing that stuck to me when the record went off, it was like, wow, I don't think he played the same melody twice. And that's where I got my style from. I said, I'm not going to repeat a cadence in a rhyme twice. So my first albums, you know, you would never hear me, you know, repeat a cadence. It was, you know, one bar, maybe two bars, and then the next, you know, cadence was something totally different. But I was trying to do that purposely because the way I felt when the John Coltrane record went off. So I was trying to get that same effect, almost when the record goes off, that the listener's, you know, out of breath.
So in the early days of rap, when you were a 10-year-old, a lot of rappers were, you know, they had their notebook, and it was like a collection of fun stuff to fill the time and get the audience excited.
Facts.
And, you know, that's why, like, the guys who recorded Rapper's Delight could go borrow some rhymes from somebody else, right? Because it was all just fun stuff about having fun.
Right.
From the moment you appeared on record, you were doing something very different. There were people doing other things. You know, Melly Mel had a lot of songs that were songs.
Right. Facts.
But when you got into the studio, even as an 18-year-old, like, I mean, there's a famous story that Marley Marl, who's, you know, one of the most significant figures in the history of hip hop, just didn't get it. Just was not into it.
Word up. Word up, man.
Was that like Biz invited you over? And
Actually, Eric B, a friend of mine, Alvin Tony, brought Eric B to my house. And Eric B comes in the house and said, I know Mr. Magic and Marley Marl. I'm looking for a rapper to make a record. So me and Eric B went to Marley's house. But around that time, I was, like I said before, I was kind of like creating my style, shaping my style, you know, like knowing what I wanted to do and how I wanted to sound. For the most part, I was always a laid back person, man. So when I get to Marley's house, I'm still that, you know, young kid from Long Island. I'm not 100% confident on what I'm doing. Not sure if the great Marley Marl definitely, you know, was going to like what I was doing. So I got a lot of strikes against me. So I'm there. We start recording. Gets to the end of the verse. He stops the track. And he was like, all right, yo, we're going to take it to the top. He said, I like the way it sounds, but put a little more energy into it. So I'm like, all right, go back to the beginning. Comes on, and it's the melody. So it's turn up the bass, check out my melody, hand out a cigar.
Turn up the bass, check out my melody, hand out a cigar. I'm letting knowledge be born, and my name's the R. A.K.A. I am not like the rest of them, I'm not on the list. That's what I'm saying, I drop lines like a...
Anyway, he plays it again, this time he stops it halfway. He was like, yo, maybe if you stand up, because I'm sitting on his couch. He had his little studio set up in his couch. He said, maybe if you stand up, it'll be a little more. So now I'm kind of understanding, you know, really what's going on. But, you know, I said, Marley, I could stand on the couch, but it's going to sound the same.
Turn up the bass, check out my melody, hand out a cigar. I'm letting knowledge be born, and my name's the R.
I didn't want to change my style. I know how I sound. I know what suited me better.
Has the mic off and distorting, ready to explode. I keep the mic at Fahrenheit, freedom Z's and make them cola. The listener's system is kicking like solar as I memorize, advertise.
So if I was going to say to somebody that wasn't a big hip-hop head, what is the thing that Rakim brought to the game? Why is Rakim one of the greatest rappers of all time, if not the greatest? Like, I think it would be easy to just say, like, oh, you know, lyricism, right? Like, everybody's rapping about partying and Rakim is rapping about knowledge of self. And that's true. But to me, the greatest distinction is about flow. That the sound of you rapping was so dramatically different from the rappers who went before you, including the great rappers who went before you. How did you build that? Like, we heard the inspiration for that was, you know, you sit down and you hear My Favorite Things by John Coltrane or whatever, and you think, what if it could be something else? But like, how did you build it? Were you, you know, writing out the meter in your book? Were you trying line by line on stage? Like, how did you make it?
I think the main thing I used to try to do was dissect the music or the beat that I was writing to. I love melodic samples because I'm able to hear other things in them. People might hear a song and they, you know, they hear the bass line or they might hear other things in the music And I use that to help make the style. I like to accent certain words off, you know, the music. My thing is to try to make, or should I say, I try to implement what I'm doing as if I'm an instrument. So if the beat is doing something and I hear the music and I hear little rhythms in the background, then maybe I'm the guitar on this song and I'm doing the rhythm like the guitar. Or I might hear a hi-hat riding through the whole song that's just, you know, dope. And I might ride the hi-hat, you know, depending on. But I would find something to help create the style. And then from that, I would play off of that. And I always thought if I can hear the music different, then I can always make a new style. So I think that's what it was, just trying to implement the music in a way that sounds like I'm a part of the band.
You described yourself as a laid-back dude and that was part of what you were putting onto record.
Yes.
I would say, like, the guys that came in your wake, the guys who came after you and were huge stars, you know, 5 years and 7 years after you, your Jay-Z's and your Biggie's, they built on your style by having this similar flow characteristics, but also a kind of quality of talking, like almost a conversational quality. And you described yourself as laid back on these records. And you are intense. Like, one of the qualities of your rapping on these records is how unrelentingly intense it is. So it's a little more than just, like, I understand that you're not being... that you're not doing jazz hands. You know what I mean? Like, you're not out there on the stage being Busy B. No disrespect to Busy B. You could rock any party anytime, right?
Facts.
But just because you're not out there goofing, like, wave your hands in the air like you just don't care who came to party, like, your level of intensity is enormous on these records.
Yeah, you know, you gotta try to pull it out, you know, when you need to. But that's my altered ego. And, you know, everybody gotta, don't push that button aside. You know what I mean? But I think, you know, for the most part, my overall mannerisms is laid back. And, you know, a lot of records I do, it shows. But, you know, of course, you always gotta turn it up. You gotta try to turn it up.
Well, I'm gonna play a little bit of Paid in Full here, which was the title track from your first album with Eric B.
Yes,
and
sir.
This, like, one of the most legendary hip-hop records ever. And I think probably a relatively laid-back Eric B. and Rakim record, but I think when our audience hears it, they'll notice that is relative.
Coming up with Lynch, so I start my mission, leave my residence, thinking how could I get some dead presidents. I need money. I used to be a stick-up kid, so I think of all the devious things I did. I used to roll up, this is a hole-up, ain't nothing funny, stop smiling, you still don't nothing move but the money. But now I learn to earn, cause I'm righteous. I feel great, so maybe I might just search for a 9-to-5. If I strive, then maybe I'll stay alive. So I walk up the street, whistling this, feeling out of place, cause man, do I miss.
There's a few times just in that little, where you flip your flow to roll up this is a hold up part, is like, just as the beat changes. And, you know, I'm like imagining you as a 19 year old, or however old you were when you wrote that.
Yeah, I was 17, 18.
Thinking of something that nobody in rap music had figured out yet. You know what I mean?
Yeah, man. Just, you know, pushing the envelope. And also, you know, like the Paid in Full concept. When we came up with the idea, the creative juices start flowing. You're like, all right, yeah, paid in full. Yeah, I'm going to tell everybody to get paid in full. And then it's like, okay, nah, how is that going to happen? Like, if it was that easy, everybody would be paid in full. So now I'm like, well, okay, well, I'm going to come up with a way to tell them how to get the money. So, you know, just trying to, you know, figure it out and be entertaining and also informal. You know what I mean? And then, you know, you're thinking about, well, what about when the record come out? People say, well, yeah, you know, you're talking about getting paid in full, but you didn't give us no instructions. So that was kind of the, you know, basically, you know, 9 to 5. You got to work. That's what it is. You got to work hard. You know what I mean? You grow up, we do stupid things when we're young, and, you know, that's not getting paid in full. You got to be smart, and you got to work.
Did you have an understanding when those records came out of what their real impact was? And I mean, beyond just being hit records, they were hit records. Like, I'm sure you could go out and buy a chain if you wanted to in a way that you couldn't before. But, like, did you see hip-hop changing as those records percolated through the hip-hop world?
Nah, to be honest, I'm still that kid trying to see if I'm resonating with the world or what part of the world I'm resonating with. Still like testing the waters. I'm paying attention to the feedback. I'm paying attention to the magazine write-ups. Everything I can get my ear on, it's like, you know, I'm curious. When we did them records, of course, I tried my best to do some real groundbreaking work or push the envelope or say things that haven't been said, say things that's profound. But you don't know if you did it. You know what I mean? You don't know until the people let you know. So, you know, that first album, when it was done, we put it out, and I had to wait to see how people liked it. You know what I mean? To see if I was doing the right thing, saying the right thing. And I'm also real humble cat, man. I try not to let certain things get to me. I don't want to ruin it. You know, I played sports all my life, and I remember learning how to take compliments and not let it get to you, because somebody can tell you, you know, you can have a good game and somebody could tell you how good you was, and you let your head get big, and the next week you get your kneecap pushed back. So I was always humble because I didn't want to get my kneecap pushed back. So I learned how to respond to accolades. But with this here, you know, people telling you you're good and people telling you your music is dope, you know, I'm listening, but I don't want it to get to me. I don't want it to affect my process, you know what I mean? So I'm trying to be humble and modest while I'm getting the information. But, you know, after a while, it's overwhelming to me listening to people tell me, you know, how my music sounds to them, how I MC to them, or how it affected them. And I had to, you know, realize that I was doing something different, but it took a while.
So much more with Rakim still to come. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Sattva. Sattva luxury mattresses are every bit as elegant as the most expensive brands, but because they're sold online, they're about half the price. Visit SAATVA.com/NPR and save an additional $200.
This message comes from The Run-Through with Vogue. Listen as designers, Vogue editors, and industry icons like Erykah Badu and Florence Pugh have in-depth conversations about fashion and culture. New episodes are released each Thursday wherever you get your podcasts.
Somewhere in an alternate universe where Hollywood is smarter.
And the Emmy nominees for Outstanding Comedy Series are Jet Pacula, Airport Marriott, Freppel, Dear America, We've Seen You Naked, and Allah in the Family.
In our stupid universe, you can't see any of these shows, but you can listen to them on Dead Pilot Society, the podcast that brings you hilarious comedy pilots that the networks and streamers bought but never made. Journey to the alternate television universe of Dead Pilot Society on MaximumFun.org.
I'm Jesse Thorne. You're listening to Bullseye. My guest is the rapper Rakim. Ice-T made this great documentary about rapping, specifically about rapping. Mm. And there's a segment where you're in there talking about how you write your rhymes.
Right.
And you're showing the kind of intense care that you put into it.
Yes, sir.
And it was extraordinary. I mean, nobody in that film takes their craft lightly, you know what I mean? But like the intensity of the almost like charting your rhymes that you did was pretty extraordinary.
Yes.
And I think that is one of the things that makes your rapping so special. I also wonder if you ever thought about how your music or your career would be different if you were the kind of guy who instead just kind of like went into the studio, turned on the spigot, let it go for a while, and turned off the spigot and went home. You know, because there certainly are great rappers for whom that is the way they make records, you know? So I wonder if you ever thought about, what if I did this different?
Definitely, you know. It's funny, my father one day, he was watching how I was real particular on what shows I would go to, or, you know, how I would, you know, move around in the rap game. I remember Eric B, you know, I was real upset with Eric B because he went and told my pops. You know, I guess Eric thought I was still a kid. You know, I'm only 17, 18. I get it. But he went and told my pops that I didn't like going to the studio all the time. And I didn't like the extracurricular, certain parties that Eric wanted. Yo, Rod, let's go here. I'm like, for what? Rod, let's for what? So he, you know, Eric B seen how particular I was with things. So I guess he thought that I was kind of not participating or not doing some of the things that he felt we needed to do. So he went and told my pops. My pops came to me and asked me about it. And he did say, you know, this music thing, you have to hit while you're hot. And that echoed in my head, man, still to this day. And, you know, it's just something that my father was trying to tell me, but I felt that, and I said, this music genre here, Dad, it's a little different. I feel like people get tired of you quick. I said, it's real, real, you know, technical. I said, I don't think going to everything, every party in town, just because, you know, it's a party, is good. I said, I wanna be around for a long time. So, you know, he understood what I was saying, but he also, you know, was right with what he was saying. You know, any music business, any genre, you know, you gotta hit when you hot.
I want to play a little bit of a record from later on in your career, from the time when you were signed to Aftermath. It's from a Jay-Z album, The Blueprint 2. And I really thought you ripped this song up. Like, you really sound great on this record.
Thank you.
It's called The Watcher. Let's hear a little bit of it.
I'm rated R. My brain contains graphic things. It turns traumatic teens into addicts and fiends. It's like watching a movie through a panoramic screen, which means I can see the whole planet in the scene. Cash is the topic, the object of out of pocket. Some take the topic, but those that haven't got to take away to add a profit. It's catastrophic. I take the cocky and I sit back and watch it. These New York streets is ugly. I keep it gully. The world is mine and can't nobody keep it from me. Yo, my neighborhood is never sunny. In the place where the number one cause of death is money.
So during the time that you were recording with Dre, not a lot of music came out. I have to say that at the time, I was not that surprised that not that much music came out, both because A, of all the people signed to Aftermath, almost nobody was putting out music.
Yeah, bro.
Like, there were a lot of Bishop Lamonts, no shade to Bishop Lamont, but like, there was these people signing to Aftermath and then just disappearing into a hole forever. And I was like, well, Dr. Dre is the most persnickety perfectionist in the history of rap music. Yeah, I was about to say, Rakim might be the other most persnickety.
World up, man. So, yeah, it was definitely it's a challenge trying to get on the same page, man. You know, Dre got he has a recipe that he used that works. And I had mine. We just couldn't find that fine line. You know what I mean?
Was it all that scene with Marley Marl, only it's Dr. Dre and you're both grown up? 35, 40 year old man.
Word up. You know, it's Dre pulling me this way, trying to get me to rhyme, you know, I guess topic wise, and me knowing or feeling like that wasn't good for Rakim, especially at this time in his career. But yeah, you know, again, You know, I know for him, it's hard for him to pull away from his recipe. And I didn't feel that I should have changed mine as well. So it's difficult, but I learned a lot while I was out there, man. I stayed out there for maybe 3 years in California. You know, just being around Dre gave me a better understanding or just a little extra love for creating and putting that extra skill or that extra time or that, you know, extra know-how into what you do. You know, he's a perfectionist, Tom Tim.
I want to ask you, like, how is it different for you to write and record the songs that you've made in the last 10 years or so as a, you know, not just a grown-up, but like as a middle-aged man? You know, where your main living is probably being made from your catalog and touring, you don't need to make platinum records to earn a living. So how is it different to go into the studio and be like, here I am, a man, you know?
I think it puts a lot in perspective, a long journey, but I think at this point it's you know, you get the justice. You feel like, you know, you made the right decisions as far as sticking to what you love. And yeah, man, it's you know, you gotta kind of say, all right, well, if anything, I'm more mature now. I'm more disciplined now. I'm a better person. I'm a stronger person. I lived a lot of life, so I should have a lot more to say. And, you know, I just fix myself on, you know, the journey and who I am and who I become and hopefully what's ahead. I love music, man. I love the form of painting pictures with words and trying to do it in a way that, you know, stands out. I was about to say my age. Yeah, I'm 55 right now, man. And I can't see not formulating words into paragraphs, into stories, into pictures. Like I can't see myself not doing that. Even though sometimes it's the hardest crap to do in the world. You know what I mean? It's definitely not easy, but I don't want to stop doing what I'm doing. I love it.
There aren't a lot of rappers who have the life that you have. It feels like for the last now 25 years, you've had a life that's involved a lot of like stability and spending time with your kids.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
That must be something you chose.
Yes. Yes, man. That means a lot. You know, being a man first, being a good husband, being a good father. I never wanted my kids to not know me. So I made it my business. I used to fly home every weekend, man. We used to get 2 days off on the road. After that last show of the week, I would take the red eye home, and then I would take the last plane back. And I barely make it to stage, getting off the plane, coming from the airport, going straight to stage sometime. But I always wanted to be a father first. If you take care of your responsibilities and you do what you're supposed to do, I felt my job would be a little easier. That's, you know, inspiring yourself. You know what I mean? To me, like, there's no bigger thing that I can do than that. So if I can do that, then I can be a better rapper. Being a good father is the hardest thing in the world. Even though sometimes you may be doing everything right, sometimes your kids might not see it. They may think that you're doing everything against them. So if I can do that good, then it'll help me be a better rapper, because I'm doing what I'm supposed to do. You know, I'm you know, being there for my kids. I'm being informal. I'm firm with them. I'm fun with them. You know, I'm what you call a good father, man. And that there makes me feel good. So everything else is easy.
Well, Rakim, thank you so much for taking this time to talk to me. You're welcome back on the show anytime. It's a real honor to have you.
Amen. Thanks for the welcome, Matt, man.
Rakim, if you want to see him live, it's a great show. You can catch him playing across the country with acts like LL Cool J and Big Daddy Kane. That's the end of another episode of Bullseye. Bullseye is created from the homes of me and the staff of Maximum Fun in and around Greater Los Angeles, California. Although this week, I went home to San Francisco and the Mission District and my mom's apartment, and specifically her basement, where I found a flyer that I made when my then co-host on this show, Jordan Morris, and I were still in college doing college radio. And for a fundraiser, we did an entire episode of the show from the base of the campus of UC Santa Cruz in our underpants, tidy whities specifically. Our show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson. Our producers, Jesus Ambrosio and Richard Roby. Our production fellow at Maximum Fun, Brianna Paz. We get booking help from Mara Davis. Our interstitial music is by the great Dan Wally, a.k.a. DJW. Our theme song is Huddle Formation, written and recorded by the great band The Go Team. Thanks to them and to their label Memphis Industries. And hey, guess what? Bullseye is now on Instagram. We are going to share interview highlights and looks behind the scenes and cool stuff we think is cool. You can find us there on the Insta at Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. And follow us and tell everybody you know to get with it. At Bullseye with Jesse Thorne on Instagram. Let's go. I think that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, BetterHelp. When you're carrying around a lot of stress, therapy is a safe space to get it off your chest. If you're considering therapy, give BetterHelp a try at betterhelp.com/NPR to get 10% off your first month.
This advertisement comes from our paid sponsor, Fundrise. High interest rates mean that real estate assets are available at a discount compared to previous valuations. The Fundrise flagship fund plans to expand its billion-dollar real estate portfolio over the next few months. Add the Fundrise flagship fund to your portfolio at fundrise.com/NPR. Carefully consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the fund before investing. Read the prospectus at fundrise.com/flagship.
I'm Miles Parks. I cover voting and election security for NPR. Across the NPR network, we report rigorously on the forces seeking to disrupt democracy and provide communities with reliable information. It's Public Media Giving Days, the perfect time to stand with the facts by donating now at donate.npr.org. Thank you.